Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Over the past week, I've been travelling with a delegation of bishops from North America and Europe on their annual pilgrimage of solidarity to the Christians of the Holy Land. A visit which may have concluded in an unusually silent Bethlehem, with snow thick on the ground and on the rooftops, but with a final statement on the part of the bishops, which was far from silent. In fact, in this statement, the bishops made an appeal for peace in the region. Where people, they said, are living through dark and dramatic events such as the conflict in Gaza and southern Israel, civil war in Syria, and increasing polarization within Israel and Palestine. Developments, they write, which have caused profound anxiety for all, for the Israelis and Palestinians, for Jews and Muslims, but particularly for the dwindling Christian population. I've asked Sean Patrick Lovett to read you the last paragraph of the statement. Just listen.
With the local bishops, we encourage practical support for the vulnerable, the formation of young people, and every effort for the promotion of peace. We encourage Christians to come on pilgrimage to the Holy Land, where they will experience the same warm hospitality we received. We shall work hard to persuade our respective governments to recognize the root causes of suffering in this land and to step up their efforts for a just peace. We echo the call Pope Benedict made recently in his speech to the Holy See's diplomatic corps. Following Palestine's recognition as a non-member observer state of the United Nations, I again express the hope that, with the support of the international community, Israelis and Palestinians will commit themselves to peaceful coexistence within the framework of two sovereign states, where respect for justice and the legitimate aspirations of the two peoples will be preserved and guaranteed. Jerusalem, become what your name signifies, a city of peace, not one of division.
Getting back now to my travelling with the bishops, this year on the agenda were meetings with a number of Christian communities in Gaza, Bethlehem, Beit Jala, as well as in Madaba and Zaka in Jordan. One of the fact-finding outings we all went on was in the Kremizan Valley, where we heard about legal struggles to protect local people's lands and religious institutions from the encroachment of the security barrier, the so-called wall. By the way, in the final statement, the bishops promised to continue urging their respective governments to act to prevent what they referred to as this injustice. While there, I filed this report and would like to share it with you, even if the sound quality is not of the best.
If you ever travel to the Holy Land, you know it's all about borders, both geographical and interior. Huge great walls, twice the size of the Berlin Wall, that snake round and about the West Bank settlements built on Palestinian land. Begun in 2002, the walls are still being built today. A sad sight indeed, as Pope Benedict XVI said when he visited the Holy Land in 2009. Famous here is the one begun in the Kremizan area, close to a village near Bethlehem, Beit Jala. The purpose is to divide it from two Israeli settlements on facing hilltops, Har Gilo and Gilo. The Kremizan's Christian community is desolate. Their road will become a military one. The families that live there will no longer be able to access their terraced olive groves and vineyards. Life will become impossible for 58 Palestinian families. The Salesian sisters, who run a school there, will have the wall running through the property. Around 400 children from poor or broken families will no longer be able to access the premises. A spring of water will be out of reach. Access will be via one guarded entrance. And if those who own the land do not cultivate it, they will lose it, according to the laws that apply in the West Bank already. This pending threat of the wall encouraged the sisters to bring the matter to court in 2006. How this sad story of geographical barriers will end remains to be seen. What's certain is that the Kremizan Wall story, recently picked up by the international media, has become a symbol of resistance against the so-called apartheid wall, a symbol of hope.
Getting back to the final statement the bishops wrote up, in it they also pointed to the moving testimonies from religious women involved in the care of migrant workers, trafficked persons and prisoners, issues which related a special way to this year's theme, suffering and vulnerable people in the Holy Land.
My name is Sister Manuela Mikalev, and I belong to the Franciscan Missionaries of Mary.
Your prison ministry, Sister, is to Christians.
Yeah, we are not allowed to see other people. According to Israeli authorities, we are supposed only to meet Christians because we go in the name of the Church. It is the Patriarchate who has asked us 17 years ago to do this work.
How do the prisoners greet you?
Oh, they are so happy. They will be waiting for us behind the windows to see when we arrive sometimes. We are really good friends.
Do you see a parallel between the pain and suffering that the Palestinians go through here and the pain and suffering of these people in the prisons?
It's a different suffering. In prison, you have the suffering, first of all, of lack of freedom. Most of them that we know are away from their families because they are foreigners. Whereas the Palestinians, it's a continual hardship. They have no freedom because they cannot move from the West Bank to Jerusalem. Their freedom of movement is very limited. They have no work, so they are all anxious, how are they going to bring up their family? What are they going to give them to eat? How they are going to dress? It's a different suffering.
My name is Sister Azizet. I'm from the Kombone Missionary Sisters.
The trafficking that goes on between the Sinai and Egypt?
The one that I work with, they are mostly Africans who come through Sinai by the human traffickers. They have to pay a lot of money, thousands of dollars. In order to get this money, they torture them, and the money is sometimes $40,000, $50,000 per person. The women are raped, and whatever torturing they use, they use it in order to get the money.
So it's a business?
It is a big business, an international business, I call it, because the money is paid all over.
So Egypt knows about it, Israel knows about it, everyone knows about it?
Everybody knows about what is happening and what is going, because it is always in the media, but nobody do nothing. I feel like at the time of slavery, everybody knew about it and nobody was doing anything. And it's the same what is happening now for the African who are raped, tortured in Sinai. Nobody do nothing and everybody knows everything. Yeah. This is my pain and my frustration.
So what's being done about these people once they get to Israel?
Till June, these people were left to room in Israel with only 3 months permission to stay without no work. But now they are detained in the detention centers without any judgment or without any refugee status determination. They are kept for 3 years in prison.
In the final statement, the bishops also write as to how they were struck by the strength and fortitude of the people they met, describing it as an enriching experience, commenting on the vibrant celebration of Mass in Zarqa in Jordan. It was ahead of this Mass that I spoke to the Director of Programs at Caritas Jordan. His name is Omar Abawi, and he shared with me information about the situation regarding Syrian refugees in Jordan. As we know, the endless slaughter of the conflict in Syria is a top concern for Pope Benedict, who reiterated his appeal for an urgent ceasefire there during his address on Monday, 7th of January, while speaking to diplomats accredited to the Holy See. On this occasion, the Pope said, "I renew my appeal for a ceasefire and for the inauguration as quickly as possible of a constructive dialogue aimed at putting an end to a conflict which will know no victors but only vanquished if it continues, leaving behind it nothing but a terrain filled with ruins."
Je renouvelle mon appel afin que les armes soient déposées et que prévale le plus tôt possible un dialogue constructif.
The brutal conflict in Syria has displaced more than 1 million people, many of whom have fled to neighbouring countries such as Jordan. Mr. Abawi highlighted how officials are predicting that the flow of Syrian refugees is likely to increase, with a further 500,000 Syrians expected to flee across the border in the next few months. He said 1,700 refugees crossed the border from Syria into Jordan in one day alone last week. But why don't we listen to him for a moment? Who are these refugees? They're all fleeing from war, obviously, from a dire situation. Are they mainly men, women, families, or a bit of everything?
60% they are female and children. And when we ask them, where's your husband or your brother or your father, they stay in Syria. Or I don't know, the answer said, because some of them, they joined other groups, and some of them, they prefer to stay as a guard to protect their properties, or they are killed.
So the people who arrive here, these refugees, are traumatized?
Of course, they are fully traumatized. They are feeling insecure. Our main activities targeting the Syrians, it's the home intervention and home visits.
What are some of the issues that these refugees have to face? You mentioned early marriages, sexual harassment, child labor. How does that fit in?
Unfortunately, this is what happens when the refugees come to live in the other country and they are in limited resources, lack of money, looking for work, looking for something to live. So one of these steps, they are forcing their daughters to marry Jordanian guy, because the Syrian guy say, us without food, without anything, and I'm afraid about her, and I'm afraid about what the situation will bring to her. The parent, they are forcing for the early marriage. Now it's like a common bad issue in Jordan. On the other hand, the child labor, the Syrians not prefer to send their children to schools because of integration, difficult integration, and because of the school is crowded. But it is not the main reasons. The main reason, it's they are asking their children to be child earners,
breadwinners,
yes, in the streets between the cars, to bring money every day, and the scenario for the refugees to increase more and more. And till April, they are saying about 500,000, from 400,000 to 500,000. And in last week, in just last week, 7,000 Syrian refugees entered Jordan. And in one day, around 1,700 refugees in one day. So it's like a high number of running and escaping from the conflict.
Now we've listened to the Director of Programs of Caritas Jordan, Mr. Omar Abawi. I'd like to move on and bring you another example of the inspirational goodwill on the part of Christian communities the bishops witness to, while supporting the work undertaken in this region to build a better future. The work, this time, of Catholic Relief Services in Gaza. I spoke to Bishop Gerald Frederick Kikanas of Tucson, Arizona, following his field visit there. Bishop Kikanas is chairman of the Board of Catholic Relief Services. Let's listen.
We did have an opportunity to see some of the damage that occurred during the recent bombing. It was very strategic bombing because you could see individual buildings that were struck, like the Office of Ministry, one of the ministries there, where the building was totally destroyed, a stadium which was totally destroyed in the midst of a neighborhood. There was collateral damage, of course, to some of the adjacent buildings, but the massive destruction occurred in the buildings that were targeted. What was very moving was to hear the terror that people felt during that time, because the bombings took place at night. There was no electricity. People were terrified hearing the explosions. And then they talked about hearing the sound, the whir of the drones, and how terrifying it was for the children being in the darkened home, hearing these noises, not knowing whether one of these bombs would strike their own home. I mean, it's almost unimaginable how people had to live in such terror and fear. And one of the things that people said to us was it was not only this experience, but the recalling of the previous destructions that took place in Gaza. It kind of brought it all back, so it was like a second trauma to have to endure. We had an opportunity to talk to a number of young adults in Gaza. It's amazing to me their daunting spirit, despite all of the challenges of being in an occupied area, despite all the challenges of just having survived another bombing scene experience. Nevertheless, they have hope. They have confidence that somehow things are going to get better. But they describe very vividly the experience with their families. One woman has three boys, and she said that she was just so concerned how to keep her children inside. She had taken part in a program the Catholic Relief Services conducts, which is a risk reduction program, helping parents to know what to do with children during war situations and siege. And so she had them inside. They were not able to go out for the days during the bombing. She was trying to entertain them and using some of the things she had learned about how to keep children occupied during this and how to alleviate some of their fears, because she said some of the boys were actually shaking, worried that somehow the next bomb was going to strike their home. Another man talked about how his wife was pregnant, and he lives in a zone in Gaza which is very susceptible to bombing because there are government areas there. And he had her move in with her parents, which was a little safer area of Gaza, and he was calling her every day, praying to God that she wouldn't give birth because they didn't know they could get her to the hospital. The ambulances are not easily available. We're not willing to drive into certain areas. And he was responsible then for the three children they had, and he brought them into one room in the house, which he thought was the safest room in the house. And there they huddled and stayed during the whole siege. So, you know, you can see that this was obviously a terrifying moment for many people, and one that certainly leaves its scars.
It was an emotional visit for you personally.
Very much so, especially listening to these young adults who are obviously eager to make a success with their lives, to do something valuable with their lives. You know, the one amazing thing about people on the West Bank and in Gaza is that they're very well educated. As one young person said to us, we have nothing else to do but to study. And they are studying, they are learning, they're developing skills. The sad part is, of course, they have no opportunity to use those skills. We heard here in Bethlehem that unemployment is about 50%, and that a young person who has a degree has little opportunity to work. Well, of course, it's even worse in Gaza. There just is no work. So it was a very moving experience.
You've been listening to Bishop Gerald Frederick Kikanas of Tucson, Arizona, who's also chairman of the Board of Catholic Relief Services. Among the issues the bishop's pilgrimage focused on this year in a special way was education. As they themselves put it in their statement, quote, "We are also called to recognize and tell others how faith in God brings light into the lives of people in the Holy Land. One of the ways in which this happens is the Church's commitment to education, a tangible investment in the future. Nowhere is this more evident than in the University of Bethlehem, where we were struck by the stories from students." While there, I filed this report, having listened to the students. Let's listen.
Be truthful. Tell people at home what you've seen here. That was the heartfelt appeal of a young student from the University of Bethlehem, the only Catholic university in the West Bank. A message addressed to his audience, a delegation of bishops from Europe and North America. But what is the truth? Someone in the audience asked. The truth, he replied, is that we are under occupation, struggling to live in our land where even freedom of movement is denied us. And another student piped up, Israelis, she said, paint us as terrorists, but we are Christians, we are human, and we have rights. The university these students attend was founded in the aftermath of Pope Paul VI's visit to the Holy Land in 1964. It is supported by the Latin Patriarchate of Jerusalem, is run by the De La Salle brothers, and is open to all faiths. No surprise, then, to discover that Christian students here in the little town of Bethlehem, where you wake up to the muezzin's call for prayer, and where the mosque stands opposite the Church of the Nativity, are a minority. But while the students highlight the bonds of friendship and understanding that develop among the members of these two monotheistic faiths at the university, when pressed to describe their relations with the third of these faiths present in the Holy Land, the answer is not so positive. As one student put it, how can you be friends with our Israeli peers? I haven't met any. And anyway, what would happen when I'd encounter one of them at the checkpoint? Clearly the world these students encounter is one of barriers where human rights are trampled on. But the good news is that there are people on the other side of the wall who've made it their mission in life to defend human rights. Among those I met with the bishop's delegation is Daniel Sherman, an Israeli from the human rights organization B'Tselem, which recently documented on video evidence of human rights abuse taking place in the West Bank, where 2.5 million Palestinians live under Israeli military occupation, while all the while settlers live in enclaves of Israeli law within the same territory. The so-called apartheid wall here, as well as the settlements on Palestinian land that have stepped up since Palestine recently became a non-member observer state at the United Nations, are among the more visible aspects of the spiral of violence taking place here in the Holy Land, where Jesus was born, died, and resurrected. Clearly, all parties here wish to live in peace, but how do you stop that spiral of violence? The call of the Apostolic Nuncio of the Holy See to Israel, Giuseppe Lazzarotto, to the delegation of the Holy Land Coordination on their 13th annual pilgrimage echoed that of the students at Bethlehem University, the call to bring the news of the Holy Land back home with them. The Holy Land, the Archbishop stressed, needs the support of the international community.
Express the wish, you know, that even this visit, or the visit of this group of bishops, you know, will help the wider community, both within the church and outside the church, to better understand what's going on in this region, and particularly in the Holy Land, and for the international community find an effective way of supporting the efforts of so many men and women of goodwill. They are here, they exist, you know, but we have to help them. We have to support them, to give them strength and courage to go on and always look for what can help in this perspective, let us say, of the efforts being made for peace and a just solution of the problems of this region.
That was the Apostolic Nuncio Giuseppe Lazzarotto. At this point, I'd like to bring you the words of someone who, like myself, took part in this pilgrimage for the first time. He's the Bishop of the Clifton Diocese in England, Declan Lang.
Wondered myself whether it was that important that we were here. And for the first few days, I wasn't sure. And I thought to myself, what difference is this group making to the people of Palestine, Israel? But then as I listened to people more, they actually said they were very grateful for our presence because it was a sign to them, an important sign, that they weren't forgotten, because sometimes they do feel a very forgotten people.
We visited a lot of places, we spoke to a lot of people. Is there a particular memory that you're going to take back with you?
Two memories which are very strong for me. One was in Hebron, when it was pointed out that this family had to climb through their back window in order to get into their house because they were not allowed to go through their front door. I thought that's really not a way to treat people with dignity. And the second one was the weather, especially in Jordan, the high winds and the rain, and what effect this was having just on the environment of the refugee camps, that these people were now living with a lack of water, a lack of resources, and presumably just in mud and experiencing the cold and knowing that there was nowhere else to go. That was a very strong impression that was left with me.
We went there together, didn't we? And we crossed the Allenby Bridge, staying there for, I must say, a number of hours, but before we got across. The Holy Land is really a lot about borders, isn't it?
It's a lot about borders, and I was warned before I came that it's a country or countries in which you have to be very patient, not get irritated. Those borders need, as Archbishop Richard Smith said, those borders need crossing, and those borders are often found within people, first of all, rather than just external borders. And there needs to be that willingness to cross borders, to find the other.
Yes, you spoke about your need to cross internal borders, but the barriers here are very visible, aren't they?
They are very visible. And what also struck me was one of the students of Bethlehem University said that he'd never actually met an Israeli. And considering that the border is so close to us where we are here in Bethlehem, I was quite amazed. And it was quite frightening, really, as well.
The Palestinians can't even go through that border that we go through.
No, they can't, and I'm not sure what effect that must have upon them. They must feel a very limited in their freedom.
Because they can't go to Jerusalem without a permit.
They can't go to Jerusalem without the permit. I think that young man was actually asked, would he ever make friends with an Israeli? And he said, no, he felt he couldn't, because their relationship, which might be formed in friendship, could so rapidly change when the Israeli was called into military service, and suddenly he could find him at a border post checking up and perhaps causing him, you know, violence and intimidation.
The Holy Land Coordination Pilgrimage is about prayer, obviously, as well. Were there any moments you'd like to share?
I think in the shrines, just moments of quiet and silence, and just to be aware of the place. And the masses that we celebrated together, I think they were important as well. I think we are calling ourselves and other people to prayer, because prayer does change things. And the other important thing, I think, as well, is to encourage people to come on pilgrimage to the Holy Land, to discover what it's really like and what is happening here, and to give the people hope and be inspired by them. We've been treated tremendously well. We've been given great hospitality. And I so often think that in the West, that's something which we need to regain, that sense of hospitality.
Of course, pilgrimages are important at an economic level, because the people here live on this sort of activity, don't they?
They do. It brings employment to people. And Bethlehem has got one of the highest rates of unemployment in the country. So I think the more that we can encourage groups to come here, the more employment we can give, which enables people to live with a sense of dignity and purpose.
Would you like to comment on the final statement?
The final statement, I think, sums up or tries to sum up our experience of what's been happening to us in the Holy Land, and to recognise as well the challenges which are being faced by the Christian communities and other communities as well in the country as they work for justice and peace. And it's that encouragement again, as I say, that we are calling people to prayer and to pilgrimage. And I suppose the area which we were made aware of especially is the village of Krimazan, which seems to be cut off and isolated, and that seems to be so unjust, and perhaps to encourage people to speak out against that wherever possible.
And thanks there go to Bishop Declan Lang of the Clifton Diocese in England. Finally, I'd like to share with you my feelings about joining the bishops for moments of prayer. Striking moments with prayerful local communities, such as during Mass at Zarqa in Jordan, or more privately at Bethlehem University or at St. Catherine's in Bethlehem, right next door to the Church of the Nativity. But also, mostly while we were travelling, often disturbed by inevitable and unpredictable stops at the many checkpoints in this holy land. Prayers from the Psalms chosen for us each day by Monsignor Peter Fleetwood. The bishop's statement quotes from one of these Psalms. I too would like to end the programme with this quotation. For the peace of Jerusalem, pray. And that brings an end to this programme focusing on the 13th pilgrimage of the Holy Land Coordination, which this year focused on suffering and vulnerable people. For the record, the bishop's final communique was signed by Archbishop Richard Smith of Edmonton, Canada, Archbishop Juan Enrique Vives of Urgel and Andorra in Spain, Bishop Gerald Quijanas of Tucson in the United States, Bishop Stephen Ackermann of Trier, Germany, Bishop Michel Dubost of Évry, France, Bishop William Kenny, representative of the Comese, and finally Bishop Declan Lang, who we've just heard. He's the Bishop of Clifton in England and was representing England and Wales. At the same time next week, I'll be bringing you more reports and interviews focusing on this Holy Land pilgrimage. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Laudetur Jesus Christus.